today, after Matt Hancock's relationship with Gina Colodangelo brought down his career as health secretary, we ask a leading couples therapist why powerful figures risk it all for the thrill of an affair.
I've been to see the Prime Minister to resign as Secretary of State for Health and Social Care.
It's hard to think of many people in the UK for whom having an affair when pandemic rules forbade it could have led to bigger consequences. But that risk of losing it all and facing public shame didn't stop the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock.
Those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
And he's hardly alone. As long as men have been in positions of power, and that is forever, they've had a propensity to stray.
In the peaceful days of summer, Whitehall knew perhaps an undercurrent of unease.
Think of the 1960s, when John Profumo had to resign as Secretary of State for War following his affair with Christine Keeler.
Such is the attraction of the breath of scandal when it concerns other people.
Or the 1990s, when the most powerful man in the world, Bill Clinton, did have sexual relations with that woman, Monica Lewinsky.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Or to now, and a British Prime Minister whose complicated private life is often the subject of interest, even if it hasn't cost him his job.
How many children do you have?
Look, I love have to ask my children very much, but they are, they are not standing at this election.
No.
We could have picked any number of names, and it's not just politicians.
The news of Jeff Bezos' affair broke quicker than Amazon Prime shipping. It was announced on Wednesday, January 9th, that Amazon founder...
It's men like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. News of his affair led to this observation on American TV.
Men in power cheat on their wives. Oh, I mean, like, and water is wet and there's gambling in Casablanca. Okay. I mean, sorry, it's not revelatory.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why do powerful men keep having affairs? Dr. Orna Goralnik, you're a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst, and you host a television programme in the US on Showtime called Couples Therapy. I'm going to ask you specifically about why men in powerful positions, some of them famous and high profile, but many not, end up having affairs. I know you have clients yourself that fit that mold. But first, let me ask you why anyone might have an affair. You speak to a lot of couples. Are there warning signs in a relationship before something like this happens?
Sure, there are many warning signs. First of all, when couples find it repeatedly difficult to address things that are coming up between them, and the communication between them becomes thinner and thinner, or too repetitive, or the arguments are too repetitive, or the worst case is people give up even trying. So the communication becomes, again, thinner, less and less communication. When one or both partners are feeling a certain kind of malaise or even depression within the relationship, and they feel like they don't want to go home, like life feels a lot more interesting or exciting outside of the home, when there's less and less contact with each other.
Do you think there's a type of person who is more likely to cheat? And if so, what personality traits would you typically see?
I don't think there's one kind of person that tends to cheat. I think cheating or affairs can take on so many different forms and reasons that there's not one sign or one type.
So in particular, the cases here in the UK were men with a lot of power cheating on their wives who they've been together with for some time with AIDS. And it's kind of an age-old idea, isn't it? You know, I'm watching Mad Men at the moment, and It's all over that, the powerful ad executives cheating with their secretaries. And our producer, Sammy, did actually dig out a study, admittedly from 2011, but it suggested people in powerful positions are more likely to stray. Do you think that's right?
I don't know if it would be responsible of me to make that kind of prediction, but there are many reasons why people get into positions of power. I mean, some people are truly ideologically motivated and feel like they want to make a difference. And some people, they get into positions of power from indeed a need for power. And then there's the whole range in between. But if we think about the need for power and where it comes from, the underbelly of that is a deep feeling of some kind of lack. The striving for power is always compensatory. And there's, in a way, there's kind of never enough. It's very easy that for them to feel helpless, powerless, humiliated. That dimension of experience is very alive for them. And in that case, in long-term relationships, they will likely easily feel emasculated by their partners. And then humiliation breeds a need for some kind of compensatory revenge or compensatory move towards reestablishing a sense of power in themselves. To do that, it's, you know, an easy target would be someone who has less power, like an assistant or like an intern or like someone a lot younger, that will give the person back this feeling of self-worth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're saying is there's a sense that actually some of these individuals need reassurance about their power and seek it out in these relationships. What
yes.
you're describing may not fit all the high-profile cases we've talked about, but it does chime with what the former president, Bill Clinton, once said about his state when he had an affair with Monica Lewinsky.
Things I did to manage my anxieties for years, I feel terrible about the fact that Monica Lewinsky's life was defined by it.
I was also thinking about jobs themselves and the lifestyle they entail. Long hours, nights away, fairly free access to alcohol, for example. Is that the sort of environment that would lend itself to this sort of thing?
Yes, then, you know, the cracks in one's personality are filled with the lifestyle. Not to mention that when you're in the public's eye, and in the public's eye a lot, that dimension of life is constantly being poked. How much power do you have? Where's your ego? It exacerbates that aspect of life.
Do you recognize that among some of your own clients in these type of jobs?
Yes, I do. Yes. You know, what I've said so far is based on my experience with certain people, both people in power and also people that are more what we call Wall Street people here, like people that are dealing with power that comes with like having a lot of money and influence. There's a certain kind of anxiety that comes along with that and a certain way of existing that is quite disorienting and frightening for people. The need to keep generating more and more and more power, more and more and more influence. There's an anxiety of insatiability and not knowing where the beginning and where the end of it is.
Is it quite addictive, basically?
Super addictive. And the addiction is fueled by this endless anxiety that nothing is enough. Then there are issues of trust that come with that, that separate people from others. A lot of paranoia gets stoked.
And what about the other side of this? You know, the women we're talking about, often quite successful, quite beautiful aides who, dare I say, the men may not have previously attracted. There is an idea, isn't there, that power is an aphrodisiac. Is that part of this, that these powerful men have all the reasons that anyone might desire an affair, but they have more opportunity to have one because the opportunity comes to them?
Yes, it's not a cookie cutter thing, but there is one thing that you often see, and I know that from my practice too, which is that many things are projected onto people in positions of power. It goes beyond who the person is. There's kind of an air of projection of deep unconscious fantasies and idealizations that get projected onto these men because they have power. that can be intoxicating for women. And again, women who themselves might feel unsteady or like lacking in themselves are more prone to being intoxicated by these kind of projections. So in a way, there's a compatibility between both the men who are seeking these women and the women who are seeking these men. There's a certain, the dynamic often revolves around power to compensate feelings of lack.
In all of these cases, the risk of being found out is incredibly high, not just because the men, as they often are men, but I'm sure there are women as well in these situations, are often married. So they're putting their marriage on their line, but they're putting their careers on their line at times as well. And that yet they go ahead with it. Why do you think that is?
I think for me, the most interesting aspect of this is that in a way, the more dangerous the transgression is, dangerous to the marriage, dangerous in terms of what it can lead to in terms of one's public standing, what one can lose, the more dangerous the transgression, the more the compulsion to do it becomes. It's a very interesting thing about the relationship between limit and desire.
Tell me more. I'm interested.
Yeah. As a psychoanalyst, we often think of desire as in always in some kind of dialogue with limit. There's something about sexuality that is always about transgression. So the more there's a limit, the more the desire inflates. The more one has to lose in the public's eye, the more one has to lose in the marriage, in a way, the more the temptation to transgress is there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like the thrill of it.
The thrill of it, and there's something about desire. It inflates in response to limit, in response to border. The more the regulation, the more the repression, the more the need to transgress.
So by limit, you just mean the rules, what you're not allowed
yes.
to do. And if you're thinking about a powerful situation and thinking about some of the type of people you work with, are these people sometimes in the types of jobs which are quite high adrenaline, quite high stress maybe, in which they kind of seek out that type of thrill?
Right, exactly. So then there's the issue of, first of all, the type of person who goes towards these kind of high yield, high power, stressful and demanding lives. So often these are people that seek a certain level of excitation, of thrill. Then people live in certain environments that stoke more and more of that need to seek higher and higher thrills, more and more power, more and more excitement. And in that sense, a new relationship, a new exciting sexual object, a new target to conquer. And when I work with people, often I find that there's a certain underlying kind of emptiness and depression that is a driver that leads people to just seek for something outside of them, more adrenaline, more power, more of something, a certain hunger for something that will quench this kind of emptiness and terror inside of a certain, like the floor is dropping out from under them.
What kind of jobs do you come across where you might see that thrill-seeking nature?
I mean, I'm thinking of like Wall Street type guys that need kind of a high adrenaline life, and everything that is lower of a certain level of adrenaline feels kind of like the threat of death or under stimulation to them. And it can be a lot of drugs, and affairs are a way to kind of bring up a level of stimulation.
And while the affair is ongoing, what sort of pressure does that place on a relationship?
Then it gets really complicated because you get into these dynamics of what we call splitting. The home becomes a place of like domestic needs, the need for safety and a kind of a deadening type of all the home and all the wife represents to the person is what is killing the feeling of enlivenment or excitement. And then the external object becomes the source of excitement. That's where sexuality lives. That's where life is. The two dimensions of one's life become very split. Home is death. Affair is life.
So it's almost like a vicious circle then.
Yes.
Obviously, everything you're saying is speaking in general. We're not speaking about the case of Matt Hancock that I mentioned earlier in the UK, because who knows what was happening in that case and in that marriage. But one thing we do know is that the story emerged because of a CCTV image from within his office with his arms around his aide and his hands on her bum, an image that none of us can unsee, particularly because there was also a short video to go with it. I just wonder, you're talking about the risks people take and that they get bigger and bigger, and obviously with them becomes the higher chance of being found out. How do people tend to feel when they find out?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Two common things that I find people respond with, and one is pretty shocking, but people, their first reaction is rage. Rage at being exposed. Again, remember, these people are, I mean, this is a vast generalization, but if one of the reasons you even went, you felt a need to go towards the affair, is because you're prone to humiliation and you're trying to compensate for some feeling of humiliation, when the affair is exposed, your first reaction is humiliation and then rage at having been humiliated. You'd expect people to feel more kind of remorse or worry, but it's often first rage. And of course, a great deal of dread, because a lot is put on the line. Now, if a person can go through an honest psychological process, then of course, then one is brought to more self-reflection, remorse, taking a look at what really happened there. I mean, it's a chance for people to do a certain kind of reckoning, psychological reckoning. But that is a big psychological ask of people, to go through that process.
Can I ask about what it might mean for the wife or the husband who has been cheated on? Presumably, it can be quite humiliating, especially if it becomes public and it's a high profile case.
The spouse, you know, the first thing, because it's public, we're talking again about what is the meaning of these actions in the context of one's community. It's not only within the context of the marriage. Public humiliation is, you know, it has a life of its own. It's its own injury, and it's a terrible injury.
How difficult was it to go through something so private, so personal, under the glare of the spotlight as the First Lady?
It was really hard. It was painful.
Aside from that, there's the issue of trust and what's happening within the marriage and betrayal. But I think the public humiliation becomes the primary focus, and then only later one can figure out what's going on within the marriage.
Coming up, what happens when couples decide to stay together after an affair? I suspect what I'm about to ask you might take some of the excitement out of a situation like this for individuals involved. But what about the idea of dealing with some of these issues by embracing open relationships? Has that become more common and acceptable in recent years? Could it be a good thing? Or do you think it tends to be better to avoid that?
The jury's out for me on this, because a lot has changed, especially with younger people. I do think there's been like several shifts in culture, both like the gay culture has introduced like a new way of thinking about relationships. And then, you know, the increasing popularity of arrangements like ethical non-monogamy and poly relationships. So I'm watching things evolve. And it's very interesting for me to watch certain couples in which, let's say, one person is more inclined to think about ethical non-monogamy as a way to resolve certain kind of deadness in the relationship. And other people are like, no, this is going to destroy what we have, the special thing we have. I don't know yet. I find it interesting that people are moving towards those kind of experiments. The classical view of couples therapist is that those kind of what we call exits are not healthy for the relationship, that they undermine the relationship. But I'm not sure.
And let me ask you about relationships after an affair. Is it possible for them to come out stronger? If you look at relationships that survive it against those that don't, what are the differences that you see?
I think it is possible for relationships to come out stronger, for sure. I mean, I've worked with plenty of couples that have, people have had affairs and the couple has had to kind of reckon with it and then kind of rebuild their relationship. There's always a certain kind of scarring that is left and a certain kind of loss of innocence and loss of idealization and loss of an ideal of a relationship or of a marriage that is there. And it's a painful scar. But what is gained is a deeper take on who each person in the marriage really is, as opposed to the idealized version of them. And I find that if people work through this kind of impasse or this kind of betrayal and find themselves again, their relationship ultimately, even though it's scarred, is deeper and more real and in a way more resilient.
What about avoiding getting there in the first place? You've obviously taken me through the stages of an affair and relationship breakdown. How can you try to avoid to be in this situation in the first place? What can couples do?
I think trying to remain as open as possible with each other, both about difficulties that are brewing within the relationship, but also about who each person is, because some of the reasons people have affairs are not always in response to what's brewing in the relationship, but sometimes it's in response to what is brewing within each person. And I think if couples develop a certain kind of psychological bandwidth and curiosity about each other, there might be less of a need to go outside of the relationship and address whatever is brewing outside of the relationship, but one can find ways to address it within the relationship. But it requires a lot of openness, willingness to remain curious about the other person and about what is brewing within the relationship. So I'd say psychological openness and curiosity are the key factors.
And are there any practical things?
Talk, listen, don't try to lock down and enforce things. But when you feel the compulsion to lock things down, try to move in the other direction and kind of lean back, open up, listen. Don't try to resolve things by locking things down with rules and regulations. It's just going to increase the impulse to flee.
I guess I want to ask you, like, obviously communicating is really important. But if I think about like the kind of pressures that come on a long-term marriage, there's certain things that become mundane in a long-term relationship, particularly where kids are involved. You're kind of like clearing up children's and dog's poo, and you don't have time for date night, and you don't have time to talk, and you might catch a box set at 11 at night, and you're probably absolutely exhausted and you just fall asleep after that. And then there are children in your bed at 2 a.m. Do you think communication is the answer to that? Or are there kind of specific things couples in that situation can do?
No, I think the first answer to that is before communication is, first of all, for each person to find a way to establish some way that they can come back to their own boundaries and their own existence. In a way, there's, you know, in the scenario that you're describing, there's like a certain kind of unavoidable enmeshment and a loss of boundaries and a loss of self. So I don't think necessarily, I mean, this is like a funny thing for a couples therapist to say, but I don't think communication is always the first answer to that. I think in a way, separateness is the first thing one should address, like time alone, time without kids, without partner, just to reestablish oneself. And then with a certain kind of distance, one can see each other more clearly, desire can emerge. So in a way, boundaries are the first place I would go to.
Here's to more time alone. Orna, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for this very interesting conversation.
That was Dr. Orna Goralnik, whose show Couples Therapy is on Showtime in the US. I haven't seen it, but our executive producer, Archie Bland, loves it. Check it out if you're in the US, and hopefully it will be in Britain and elsewhere soon. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.